Well, I want to respond. Thank you, Peter, but I want to also respond how happy I am to be back. I really enjoyed my sessions with you last year. I see we're very, very small group today, but can't control the weather. And I'm very happy that you invited me back because I'm looking forward to studying with you again. After discussions with Dave Fetterman, we decided to continue with Jacob, which is almost a continuation of what we did last January. We began with the beginning of Exodus and went through, I think we finished with the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. And the normal progression would be to study Isaac, but to be quite frank, Isaac isn't very interesting. He's often described as the valley between two mountains, between Abraham and Jacob. Most of the things that Isaac did were repetitions of what Abraham did. He had the same experience of telling people that Rebecca was his sister, and that he redug all the wells that his father had dug. So he was, and there's some. So we decided to skip over Isaac and talk about Jacob, and I called the class the problematic patriarch. Now I expect, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that Jacob is more problematic for me than he is for you. You folks, Presbyterians, have your connection to God through Jesus, as the Christ, as the Messiah. And as far as Jews are concerned, is a perfectly valid relationship. The Jewish relationship, my relationship with God, though, is through the covenant. It's through the covenant with Abraham. And I think we discussed this last year. And do you remember what's in the covenant with Abraham? There were three main parts. God promised Abraham that his descendants would be great, both in terms of number and in terms of stature. God promised to protect Abraham. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And God promised to give Abraham's descendants the land where the Canaanites were living, which is not the land of Israel today. They kind of overlap. They're not quite the same. So the question the Jews ask is, what did I do right to be included in the covenant this covenant with God? Was it because of some merit in me? Am I so splendid that I deserve to be part of this covenant with God? And the answer is no. In fact, quite the opposite. We are further away from God than our ancestors were. And the reason that we today, Jews today, feel ourselves part of the covenant is not because of our own merits, because of what's called in Hebrew zechut avot. In Hebrew, av is father, avot is the plural. So that would be fathers or forefathers or ancestors. Zechut is the merit. So we are included in the covenant because of the merits of our ancestors, the merits of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If it weren't for them, the covenant wouldn't exist. And God says in the Ten Commandments, so show favor to the thousands of generations of those who follow my commandments. The problem with that is a lot of Jacob's personality traits. Jacob's actions are not very meritorious. So as we go through, and that's a problem for us as to why God chose Jacob to be the bearer of the covenant, because my connection through the covenant depends partially on Jacob. So as we go through the story, we'll try to keep that in mind. Now it's difficult to to jump into the story of Jacob, because I may have mentioned to you last time, my teacher Rabbi Edelstein taught me very early on in Torah study that one of the most important things is connections. You can't pull a story out of the Bible without knowing what came before it and what came after it. So we have to go back a little bit. And it would help if you know the family tree, because there are going to be a lot of interfamily relationships in this story. So our story begins with Terah. Is that large enough for you to read? No. Okay. Terah had three sons. There was Abram, who became Abraham. There was Nahor. And Haran. Haran had a son named Lot. Remember, we talked about him. Lot was the one who went with Abraham when he left. Left his father's homeland. Abraham married Sarah. They had a son named Isaac. Nahor had a son named Bethuel. Who married a lady named Milcah. Don't have room to put there. And they had two children. One was Laban. And the other was Rebekah. Our story left off at the binding of Isaac. Abraham was called by God, or at least he thought he was called by God, to offer his son Isaac up as a sacrifice, which he was willing to do. The very next part of the story in the Bible tells of the death of Sarah. If you can see what's been going on here and compare that to the promise of the covenant that Abraham's people would be numerous, doesn't seem to be happening. The covenant is hanging by a single thread. So Abraham sends his senior servant, whose name traditionally is given as Eliezer, back to Haran to get a wife for his son Isaac. He says, "Do not let my son marry any of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. You must get him a wife from Haran." Now Haran if you can see this. This is, I'm sure we're all too familiar with the map of the Middle East these days. The family's base was in Beersheba, down here, and Hebron. They were nomads, semi-nomads. They would wander in that area, depending on where the sheep and the goats needed to graze. Haran is all the way up here, in what's now probably northern Syria or southern Turkey. So it's a long journey. I encourage you, if you choose to come back next week, I encourage you to bring a Bible with you. One of the things we like to do as we go through this, as we talk about the text, is to see what the different translations are, because they can tell us a lot about our different views of what the Bible is trying to tell us. So if you'd like to go to, in the book of Genesis, chapter 24, verse 50, I'm going to relate this story, and then we'll get into the actual text, because this is really just background to get us to Jacob. The Abraham sends his senior servants with 10 camels loaded with gold and presents and jewels and the best of the land of Canaan as a bride price. The servant gets to the well in Haran. He asks God for guidance to find the right girl, and immediately thereafter, Rebecca appears. He finds out who she is. He puts some. He gives her some bracelets and some rings. She goes back and tells her brother Laban and her father Betuel that somebody has come from the other side of the family in Canaan. And Laban immediately runs out, says, "Beloved of the Lord, why are you standing here by the well? Come into the house." The servant tells his story of what's happening and asks if he can obtain Rebecca as a wife for his master's son. It says, then Laban and Bethuel answered. Notice that it says Laban and Bethuel. Laban's character is called into question here. The implication is he's so happy to see the servant and inviting him into his house because the servant is giving away gold. And here it says Laban and Bethuel answered. Laban is so intrigued by this, so enamored of the gold, that he answers before his father, which is a breach of common etiquette in those days. He didn't show proper deference. And Laban is going to come back, is going to be a key actor in the rest of the story. So we need to bear this in mind. So Laban and Bethuel answered, "The matter was decreed by the Lord. We cannot speak to you bad or good." I think I told you, bad or good in Hebrew is called a merazim. We can't say anything to you. It's out of our hands. "Here is Rebecca before you. Take her and go, and let her be a wife to your master's son as the Lord has spoken." So when Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed low to the ground, and the servant brought out objects of silver and gold and garments and gave them to Rebecca, and he gave presents to her brother and to her mother. Doesn't say anything about Bethuel. We don't know what happened to where he was in all of this. Then he and the men with him ate and drank, and they spent the night. When they rose the next morning, he says, "Give me leave to go to my master." But her brother and her mother said, and here I'd like to ask what your Bible say, "Let the maiden remain with us." My translation says, "Some 10 days or so. Then you may go." What does yours say? Okay. The Hebrew is kind of vague. There are some commentators that think that means let her stay for a year. So the question is, why do they want to keep her around when they've already agreed that she can be Isaac's wife? Why do they want to keep her around?
Get some more gifts.
Get some more gifts. He's got 10 camels here. Maybe there's another 10 camels at the last oasis, waiting to come in if they're called. So he's trying to get looking to see if they can get more. But he said to them, "Do not delay me now that the Lord has made my errand successful. Give me leave that I may go to my master." And they said, "Let us call the girl and ask for her reply." They called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will." Now this is, in my mind, something of an amazing statement. We're generally told that the women in the Bible are portrayed as objects. They have no rights. They have no ability to do things. Here is this young woman, we're not sure how old she is, presented with this fact, and immediately she says, "I'll go." No hesitation at all. She has no idea. Well, she knows who Abraham is. She knows who Isaac is. But she's never met them before. And she's willing to, at the drop of a hat, to say, "I will go." So they sent off their sister Rebekah and her nurse, along with Abraham's servant and his men, and they blessed Rebekah and said to her, O sister, may you grow into thousands of myriads, may your offspring seize the gates of their foes. Then Rebekah and her maids arose, mounted their camels, and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and went his way. Isaac had just come back from the vicinity of Be'er Lahai Roi, for he was settled in the region of the Negev. Now remember, Sarah is dead now. And as far as we know, Isaac never spoke to his father Abraham again after the Akedah. So Isaac is kind of alone at this point. Isaac went out walking in the field toward evening, and looking up, he saw camels approaching. Raising her eyes, Rebekah saw Isaac. She alighted from the camel and said to the servant, Who is that man walking in the field toward us? And the servant said, That is my master. So she took her veil and covered herself. This was a sign that she was engaged. In effect, legally, in fact, at that point, she's already married. The servant told Isaac, Now, wait a second. Oh, yes. Rebekah saw Isaac. She alighted from the camel. Is that what you have? Back in verse 64. Okay. The Hebrew word actually means she fell off the camel. She was so knocked out that she fell off the camel. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. So now the question is, given where Isaac is, how's he going to react to this? He's estranged from his father, and now he finds that his father, without apparently even telling him, has gotten him a wife from somewhere strange that he's never seen before. There's a chance that he would reject it. But Isaac then brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he took Rebekah as his wife. Isaac loved her. This is the first time in the Bible that we're told about love between two human beings. We're never told that Sarah and Abraham loved each other. We're never told that Adam and Eve loved each other, or any of the other generations. But Isaac loved Rebekah, and thus found comfort after his mother's death, which is kind of a strange statement to make. Thinking of in today's world of psychological insights, you might say that he saw Rebekah as a mother substitute. But we get the picture, or at least we can infer the picture that we have in this union. Rebekah is the strong one, and Isaac is the strong one, and Isaac is more passive. And that's going to affect the rest of the story.
Just out of curiosity, when they're in Haran, they talk about Rebekah taking her nurse. Does that imply something about her age, or is there any, what the commentators say about that?
Well, any woman from a rich family, and this is a rich family, would have attendants. As far as the age of Rebekah, there's all kinds of different views. Some think she was as young as 10, because it was the practice back then for girls to be betrothed at a young age, even though they wouldn't consummate the marriage until they were older. So, but we don't know how old she is. We'll be told in a moment how old Isaac is. In fact, I'll spoil the surprise for you. He's 40 years old. But we have no idea how old Rebekah is. Okay, any questions so far? And I forgot to ask, any questions about anything we did last time? Anything up to now that you need to know of, because we're about to get into Jacob's story? I'm sorry?
What word for
Ahava. The word was, let's see, I think it's Ahava. Well, that Rivka Vatahivas. Vayehaveha, which is Ohev, is love. There's a synagogue in the North Hills, Ohev Shalom, lover of peace. So it's love, but it also has a connotation of fealty, loyalty. When the same word is used in the commandment, you shall love Adonai your God, v'ahavta. So it can mean emotional, but it can also mean a loyalty, a fealty, like in Shakespeare, when Shakespeare tells Essex, Lord of Essex, to love the Lord of Sussex. He's talking about fealty. But it also means romantic love. Anything else? Okay, so let's skip a bit. I have to go to chapter 25, verse 19. Would anybody else care to read?
These are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, and the Aramean of Padan Aram, sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife, because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived.
Now, Rebekah has trouble getting pregnant. So who does this remind you of?
Sarah.
What happened? What did Abraham and Sarah do when Sarah had problems getting pregnant? Sarah told Abraham to sleep with the maid and have a baby, and we know that didn't work out all that well. So here, Isaac prays to God. He takes a different approach from his father to this problem. And his approach is more successful. Go ahead, continue, please.
Okay, the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is to be this way, why do I live? So she went in to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger.
This is a key part of the story. Rebekah gets this prophecy, and we're not sure where she goes, where she went to get a prophecy from God. But she goes, not Isaac, but she goes herself, and she gets this prophecy that she's going to have twins, which in those days, of course, wasn't, there was no way to know that beforehand, and that the older will serve the younger, which is a disruption of the normal course of events. In those days, the eldest was supposed to inherit the leadership of the clan when the father died, and he was to get a double portion of the inheritance. If there were two sons, the elder would get 2/3, the younger would get 1. If there were 3 children, the older would get half, the other 2 would get 1/4 each, and so forth. So this is an inversion. And the question, one thing that we would ask as we go through the story, did Rebekah tell anybody about this prophecy? Or did she keep it to herself? And we can ask that several times as we go through the story. Did you want to ask?
I was just curious, talking back to Ishmael and Isaac, the fact that Isaac received the blessing and Ishmael did not.
Yes, and we're going to see echoes of that as well as we go through it. We haven't gotten to that yet. That's probably next week.
Okay.
So, she gets this prophecy, and we don't know if she told anybody, and if she did, who she told. Okay, please continue. We'll finish the paragraph.
When the time came to give birth at the hand, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red. All his body was like a hairy mantle. So they named him Esau.
Seir in Seir in Hebrew is hair. So Esau is a pun on the word hair. He came out of all hairy, and the hair was red, by the way.
Afterward, his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob.
Yaakov in Hebrew. Yaakov is heel, literally. So he was named heel, or as my Rabbi Gibson says, heel grabber. So what's the implication that Jacob was born with his hand on Esau's heel?
He's a social climber. He's trying to get ahead of
him. He's trying to pull his brother back so he can get out first. Even in the womb, he's trying to overtake his older brother. Okay, one more. So
Isaac is 60 years old.
How old were they when was he when they were married? 20 years he waited. He prayed to God and waited 20 years to get the response. We can see why Isaac would have been chosen as a patriarch, because he has this faith. He's willing to wait for 20 years for God to respond to him. Now, I'll probably mention this again as we go through it. The commentators, the rabbis, really, 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 really like Jacob. And they really, 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 really hate Esau. Esau became, in a later day, the name they used to refer to Rome during the Roman occupation. He was the epitome of evil. So they will do anything they can to excuse Jacob's behavior. The people back then had a view of science. They weren't anti-scientific, but their science was not good science as we know it today. And the rabbis, there's a commentator named Rashi, who I may have mentioned to you last time, who died in 1044. So he's about 1,000 years ago. And he says, it's obvious that Jacob really was the firstborn. He was the first one to be conceived. And how do you know that? Well, if you take a tube and you put two peas into the tube, like a straw, and you put two peas into it, and then you turn the tube over, which one comes out first? The one that went in second. So he says the fact that Jacob came out second is proof that he was conceived first. So all he's really doing is trying to reclaim what's really his heritage. I don't buy that. So, would somebody like to continue? Who would like to read? Go ahead. 27.
When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob.
Okay, so now we have the favoritism which Isaac did learn from his parents. Now the situation was somewhat different, and Abraham certainly made known that he loved Ishmael. But Sarah certainly did not. And Sarah was the instrument of having Ishmael expelled from the family. So here we have favoritism. And Isaac liked Esau because he liked the taste of game. These people back then ate meat very rarely. They had the flocks and herds, but they didn't kill them to eat, because that was money. They would not eat meat very often. So the fact that Esau was able to go out into the field and hunt wild game and bring it back, that was a pleasure that Isaac enjoyed. But why did Rebekah favor Jacob? And you have the information to answer that now. I'm sorry? Because of the prophecy. She knows the prophecy. She knows that Jacob is going to be the leader of the clan. He is going to be the one to inherit. So she keeps him close. And the question again is, you can imagine her doting on him and feeding him stories of the prophecy. Possibly. Maybe, maybe not. We don't know if she, again, we don't know if she told anybody, but here's an opportunity that maybe she told him how great he's going to be. She might have filled his mind with the glories to come. She might not have, but she might have. So we have a very quick picture of the two boys.
I'm just curious. The implication then is that Rebecca never told Isaac about the prophecy.
That's another question. She might have. She might not have. She might have told him, and that will come into the story in a little bit. But it's not clear. She might have, but again, she might not have. And we'll look at that both ways in a few moments. So how would you, when I teach this to my students, I'm going through this with the seventh grade right now. How would you describe Esau? What would Esau be doing if they were high school students? I'm sorry?
Football player.
He'd be the quarterback on the football team. And what would Jacob be doing?
Reading.
I'm sorry?
The nerd.
He belonged to the chess club, the math club, things like that. So you have two fraternal twins who are extremely different. And they don't get along very well, even from the beginning.
I see Jacob not as a nerd, but
he's
a politician.
The finagler. Finagler, yes.
It moves very well, right.
And it's easy, I think it's a good point, and I think it's easy, you can see how to get from one to the other if the nerd is trying to figure out a way to twist things to his advantage.
If you got into a revolving door in front of Jacob, he'd get out before you.
Okay. Okay, please continue. Continue. Yeah, sure.
Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff, for I am famished." Therefore, he was called Edom.
Edom is the Hebrew word for red, and the stew traditionally is a lentil stew, and lentil beans are red. So he was given the nickname Red because of the stew.
Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. When Jacob saw Esau, gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank, and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright.
Okay. So, what did Jacob, focusing on Jacob now, what did Jacob do wrong in this bargain?
Yeah, he asked Esau to sell him the birthright.
Right. What's wrong with that?
He didn't deserve it.
Well, if Esau is willing to sell it to him, what's the problem?
No problem.
Well, I would disagree. What kind of a guy is Esau?
Esau.
Esau is the guy who doesn't think very much. He's impulsive.
Impulsive.
He says, "I'm at the point of death, so what good is this to me?" Is he really at the point of death? He's been out hunting. We know that you can go without food for maybe a week. I mean, you'll start to suffer real privations after 2 or 3 days, but we've seen people who have been trapped in collapsed buildings or out in the wilderness. You can go without food for a long time. And besides, think about the situation they have here. Isaac is a rich guy. He has servants. This is an encampment. It's not just a tent in the middle of nowhere. There's Isaac's tent. There's tents for some of the maidservants. There's probably tents all over the place. If Esau was hungry, and Jacob said, sell me your birthright, I would imagine what he should have said is, the heck with you. You don't want to give me food? Mom will have some food. I'll go see her. Or if she doesn't, I'll go see one of the servants. Somebody's got to have some food being prepared. I don't need you. But he doesn't stop to think about the implications of his actions. He spurned the birthright. He thought so little of it, he wasn't even willing to do these other things because he didn't stop to think. And Jacob's fault, in my opinion, is that he took advantage of his brother's weakness. In another part of the Bible, it says one of the commandments is, don't place a stumbling block before the blind or curse the deaf. That, to me, that says, don't take advantage of another person's weakness. But Jacob, as the finagler, is willing to take advantage of his weakness. So Jacob can be seen to be at fault here. And we've already talked about how Esau could be seen to be at fault. He just didn't care about his birthright. And the Hebrew is very staccato. It's a series of verbs, which is rather unusual. Vayochal, vayesht, vayakom, vayelech. So he ate, and he drank, and he got up, and he went away. This is the way to describe somebody who isn't thinking about anything, who's just looking to feed his own bodily needs, and nothing else matters to him. So we already, even at this stage, and again, we don't know how old they are at this point. But the struggle for supremacy is already beginning. Okay, how are we doing? Yeah, we can do this. Okay, let's skip to chapter 27. The intervening chapters are the stories of Isaac, the story of Isaac's life. There's not much to it. And in terms of the volume, and most of it is repetition of what echoes of what Abraham did. All right. Would somebody else like to read? Please. Well, let's just start, and I'll interrupt you.
He called his elder son Esau and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Here I am." He said, "See, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food, such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may bless you before I die."
Okay, so Isaac can't see, and he's worried about how soon. He says, "I don't know when I'm going to die," and that's true of all of us. You know, we none of us know when we're going to die, but he seems to feel death approaching. So he wants to give Esau, his older son, a blessing. So now we can ask ourselves again the question: did Rebekah ever tell Isaac about the prophecy? What is this blessing that Isaac wants to give Esau? We do not know the answer to either of those questions. Okay, please continue.
Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me game, and prepare for me savory food to eat,
that I may bless you before the Lord before I die.
Now, how did Rebecca put her own spin on what Isaac wants to do? Look carefully at what Rebecca said.
Now, therefore, my son.
No, that's not a rhetorical question. What did Rebecca change in the way she related to Jacob what Isaac said to Esau?
He's going to bless him before the Lord.
Before God. She brings God into it. Isaac never mentioned God, but she did. And why would she do that?
Make it sound more important.
Make it more important?
Because of the
prophecy. She's got this prophecy lodged in her mind, and she sees everything through that prism. She thinks Isaac is going to do something contrary to what she knows is supposed to happen. So she interprets it as being that he wants to pass on to Esau the covenant. But that's not really clear. It's not really clear that that's the case.
Now, therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flock and get me two choice kids so that I may prepare for them savory food for your father, such as he likes. And you shall take it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies. But Jacob said to his mother Rebekah, "Look, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a man of smooth skin. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him, and bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my word and go get them."
Okay, so now we have another pairing. Rebecca and Jacob. Now, it's pretty obvious. What is Rebecca doing wrong here?
She's creating the deception.
Right. She's preparing to lie to her husband. But remember the type of woman we already know her to be. She's a decisive woman. She knows what has to be done, and she's ready to do it. And she feels that this is what's necessary to fulfill the prophecy. But how about Jacob's part in this?
He agrees.
He didn't want to do it.
I'm sorry?
He didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Well, but what's it? Why? What's he worried about?
Being caught.
He's worried about being caught. He has no moral scruples about this. What you'd have liked Jacob to say to her is, "We can't. Why should we? How can we do that? How can we lie to my father? He's been good to me. Yeah, he likes Esau better, but he's been a fine father. How can we lie to him?" He has no moral scruples about doing this. His only worry is about getting caught. About consequences. And she says, "Your curse be upon me." We will see that the effects of this are going to be that after this episode, apparently she never sees her son again. Sir.
So, history is written by the victors.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose there was no prophecy. Suppose Jacob and his descendants, to justify his stealing his brother's birthright, made up this story about prophecy and excused their grandmother from coaxing their son to steal his brother's birthright.
I see what you're saying. But the problem I have is if they were going to do something, I would think they would have sanitized the story even more. They left all the bad things in him, about him. We're talking about the flaws in Jacob's character because they're right here in front of us to see. If there was somebody really who really wanted to whitewash Jacob, probably would have changed the story to give him some moral scruples. What you're describing is a possibility, but that would have just given us a different story. It would have come out differently. But that's what. I'm assuming that you all remember what I told you 14 months ago. Do you remember what Midrash is? Drash is a Hebrew word that means draw out. The Bible is very sparse in some of its descriptions. It leaves plenty of room for what if. What you're doing is called Midrash. To a certain degree, one of the rules of Midrash is that you can't change the plain text. So if it says there was a prophecy, then you have to accept that as a given. So you've taken it a step further, but I have no problem with that, as long as you remember that that's not what the text says. Distinguish between Midrash and text. We've been talking about, to a certain degree, I haven't used the word, but we've been talking about Midrash. How old was Rebecca at that point? Said maybe she was 10 years old. That's Midrash, because we don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. Okay. All right, so we have another example where both of the characters involved are behaving in questionable ways. Oh, okay, we're okay. All right, would somebody else like to pick up? Somebody else like to read? We're at verse 14. Okay, so Rebecca is a conspirator, but she's a good conspirator. She's got everything covered. And we're going to see as we go through this story that they are going to fool every one of Isaac's senses. They're prepared for anything that he might do to discover the falsity.
Where is Esau now?
He's out in the field hunting. His father, Isaac, said, go out in the field and hunt some game. Yes, but you're right. You're foreshadowing what's going to come. At some point, he's going to re-enter the story and find out what's going on.
Was Esau hard of hearing, too? Isaac hard of hearing, too?
No, we'll see that. Okay, would you like to continue?
The
first thing Isaac says is, which of my sons are you? Which indicates that he might be suspicious. The question I'm going to ask you as we go through this story, is Isaac really fooled or not? Go ahead.
Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your brother.
The lie. There is no way to disguise this. Or to ameliorate it. It's a plain, blatant, outright lie. I am Esau, your firstborn.
So now sit up and eat the game so that you may bless me. But Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? He answered, because the Lord your God granted me success.
So what has Isaac done? What has Jacob done now? Well, but he brings God into the deception. He makes God a party to the deception.
Well,
God, because Adonai, your God, granted me good fortune. So he brings God into the picture. Go ahead.
Okay, and Isaac said to Jacob, come near so that I may kill you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not. So Jacob went up to his father Isaac and felt him and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau.
So he did recognize the voice, and Jacob did not try to disguise his voice, apparently. It says, so he's not hard of hearing. But the words, the lie, was powerful enough to overcome the doubt, apparently. Maybe, maybe not.
He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy and his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him.
Okay. So, all right. The blessing doesn't come for a few verses yet. This is what's called in the Bible synoptive resumptive. It tells you what happens and then goes into the details. Again, the question is, is Isaac really fooled or not? Does he really believe this is Esau? Anybody else like to read? Or 24.
He said, are you really my son Esau? He answered, I am. Then he said, bring it to me, that I may eat of my son's game and bless you. So he brought it to him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, come near and kiss me, my son. So he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his garments, and blessed him, and said,
okay, so we see now how each of Isaac's senses were deceived, assuming that he was deceived. Sight, he couldn't see, so he couldn't look and see that it was Esau. Hearing, how was his hearing deceived?
Good.
Sorry?
Good.
Hmm?
It was good.
No, yeah, but how was his hearing deceived? How did they deceive his hearing?
With the lies.
With the lie. Plain lie. I am Esau. How was his taste deceived?
Mother prepared it.
She prepared a dish.
Exactly. That, like
right. That gave it to him and disguised it up to taste like venison. How was his feeling of touch deceived? The skins on his hand. What am I missing? Sight, hearing, and taste. I'm sorry?
And the smell.
Smell. With the clothes, by wearing Esau's clothes. So they attacked every one of his senses, and Isaac was overcome. So here's the blessing. May God give you of the dew of heaven and the fat of the earth. Abundance of new grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow to you. Be master over your brothers and let your mother's sons bow to you. Cursed be they who curse you, blessed they who bless you. This is such an echo of the prophecy and of the covenant that it really again causes us to wonder whether Isaac knows who he's talking to or not, and whether he knows about the prophecy. He would not have to give Esau the blessing of be master over your brothers, because that would be expected of the firstborn. Does Isaac know about the sale of the birthright? We don't know that either. But he does give Jacob primacy over the clan. Whether knowingly or not, we're still not sure. Now, we have what you brought up. Yes.
What is "and may your mother's sons bow down to you"? What is the significance?
Well, he's going to be the son who he's talking to is going to be the master over his brothers. So he says. So he's telling the Jacob, whether knowingly or not, that Esau will bow down to him, that he will be master over.
Other brothers too?
No. You're talking about the plural. Well, and that could mean the word brothers also means relatives. Could mean other. When Esau has children, that they will also be subject to the Jacob's rule.
I guess you're going to explain this to us, but obviously Jacob's inheritance was obtained through fraud.
Yes.
How is that overcome? How is it overcome in a religious sense? You're going to tell us.
Yes, that. I am, and I'm wondering whether to tell you now. We will see that.
Okay.
We will see that as we go through. Hold that question, if you would, because it will become clear, because he will get it legitimately.
Good Lord.
Well, maybe, maybe not. All this may have been unnecessary. I think we can do this part. No sooner had Jacob left the presence of his father Isaac, after Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, then his brother Esau came back from his hunt. He too prepared a dish and brought it to his father, and he said to his father, "Let my father sit up and eat of his son's game so that you may give me your innermost blessing." His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am your son Esau, your firstborn." Isaac was seized with very violent trembling. "Who was it then," he demanded, "that hunted game and brought it to me? Moreover, I ate of it before you came, and I blessed him. Now he must remain blessed." When Esau heard his father's words, he burst into wild and bitter sobbing and said to his father, "Bless me too, father." Now, even though we told you that the rabbis really don't like Esau at all, even they find sympathy for Esau in this, Esau's pain seems real. He may not have cared much about the birthright when he thought he was too hungry, but here his tears are real, and he seems to be to honestly be reacting as a victim. But he answered, "Your brother came with guile and took away your blessing. So who is Isaac blaming?" Isaac's blaming Jacob for Esau's problems. Esau said, "Was he then named Jacob that he might supplant me these two times? First he took away my birthright, and now he has taken away my blessing." He took away my birthright. He doesn't say he cheated me out of my birthright, but he took it away. And he added, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered, saying to Esau, "But I have made him master over you. I have given him all his brothers for servants and sustained him with grain and wine. What then can I still do for you, my son?" And Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, father? Bless me too, father." And Esau wept aloud. And his father, I think I'm out of time. So, again, Esau's tears seem real. He seems really bereft that he didn't receive this blessing from his father, even though we're not clear what the blessing would have been. There's much more to talk about this episode, and I'll have to somehow summarize it. I hope we'll have more people next week. I hope the weather will be better. But there's much more to talk about this episode as far as how... whether you feel Isaac was fooled or not, what and what the implications of this will be for the next part of the story. But I think our time is up for now. Thank you for coming. How was this? Is this the kind of thing you're? I'm always open to feedback. I had a student who described this story. I had a student last year who described this story as a Telemundo video. A Telemundo video, one of the Spanish TV soap operas. Okay, well, I hope to see you again next week, and let's hope maybe there's more people here.